Next, let's remember one of the great writers of the 20th century. Alexander Solzhenitsyn recorded some of that century's brutality and violence, and he died over the weekend of heart failure. He was a Nobel laureate. He rose to fame with novels and nonfiction that exposed the horrors of Stalin's labor camps in the old Soviet Union. He also exposed the criminal nature of the Soviet regime. NPR's Martha Wexler has more on this writer who shook the foundations of the Soviet system.
One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich is must reading for every student of modern Russian literature. The novella brought Alexander Solzhenitsyn to the attention of the world and the Nobel Committee, which awarded him the Literature Prize in 1970. For years, Solzhenitsyn had written with scant hope of seeing his works in print. Then, in 1962, during the brief post-Stalin thaw, Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev ordered the publication of Ivan Denisovich. It was a grueling tale of one inmate's survival, rich in prison camp slang. Lyudmila Alexeyeva, a human rights activist in Moscow, recalls the work's appearance in an official journal as a great event in Soviet public life.
It was very important for us that such a story was published. It means that this topic after this event wouldn't be a forbidden topic.
And so Alexander Isayevich Solzhenitsyn, an unknown math teacher from the provinces, leapt to literary fame. Solzhenitsyn didn't start out as an anti-Soviet crusader. He was born in southern Russia in 1918, 1 year after the revolution. He grew up fatherless in extreme poverty during the tumultuous formative years of the Soviet Union, an era of civil war, famine, and repression. At the outbreak of World War II, Solzhenitsyn joined the Red Army. Then, in February 1945, while serving as an officer at the front, he was arrested. The secret police had intercepted his correspondence with a school friend criticizing Stalin. Solzhenitsyn, though, had not yet lost faith with the Soviet system, as his biographer Michael Scammell notes.
Solzhenitsyn was not your average communist or a token believer. I mean, it's quite clear he was fire-breathing, extreme communist when he became a communist. What got him into trouble was that, you know, he was holier than the Pope.
He believed Stalin had betrayed the revolution. And so he spent the next decade in prison, labor camps, and internal exile in Kazakhstan. These ordeals would provide the material for his greatest works. The Cancer Ward was inspired by his own affliction with the disease while still a prisoner. The First Circle drew on his internment at a scientific research station. It was there, in heartfelt discussions with other inmate intellectuals, that Solzhenitsyn began to question not just Stalinism, but the entire communist state founded by Lenin. The atrocities he witnessed propelled him to write The Gulag Archipelago. The three meticulously researched volumes documented the torture, hunger, and numbing cold suffered in the vast Soviet network of prisons and labor camps. Biographer Michael Scammell sees this as Solzhenitsyn's masterpiece, a narrative that crystallized a particular form of evil.
It turned a mealy-mouthed, bureaucratic, obscure term describing the state management of labor camps. That crazy little word, gulag, has now become a metaphor on the scale almost of the Holocaust.
Solzhenitsyn had The Gulag Archipelago published abroad. It was smuggled back into the Soviet Union, reproduced, and circulated underground. This proved too much for the Soviet authorities, and in February of 1974, they put him on a plane for Frankfurt. He was later joined by his second wife and chief editor, Natalia Svetlova, and their young children. They settled into exile in Cavendish, Vermont. The author established the Solzhenitsyn Fund, sending his Nobel Award money and gulag royalties back home to the families of political prisoners. He also plunged into a project he had conceived of as a young man, a project he saw as his most important work. It was a densely written series, more history than fiction, about the Russian Revolutionary period. From exile, he read this series, The Red Wheel, over the voice of America, sending his words back into Russia. Biographer Michael Scammell, who teaches writing at Columbia University, calls The Red Wheel a dreadful falling off of Solzhenitsyn's literary talent. Few Russians would plow through the entire Red Wheel. What's more, critics said it revealed a deep anti-liberal bias. In 1978, Solzhenitsyn shocked his admirers with a commencement speech he delivered at Harvard University, heard here through an interpreter.
How has this unfavorable relation of forces come about? How did the West decline from its triumphal march to its present sickness?
Solzhenitsyn thundered against the West's materialism, its boundless freedom, its reliance on secular law, and its spiritual and moral weakness. Many observers said the author never really got to know America, that he shut himself off from the country like a recluse at his Vermont estate. When the Soviet Union collapsed, Solzhenitsyn was able to realize his dream and return home. He flew first to Russia's Far East, the heartland of the Gulag Archipelago. As he stepped off the plane in 1994 in Magadan, in Siberia's frigid Kolyma region, Solzhenitsyn remembered the victims of the camps.
I pay homage to the land of Kolyma, where many hundreds of thousands, even millions of our murdered countrymen are buried. The land where innocent martyrs rest has become sacred, and we will honor it as sacred.
After traveling across his homeland, Solzhenitsyn settled in Moscow. He hosted a TV show where he railed against the greed and corruption of post-Soviet Russia. With poor ratings, though, it was canceled. His final big work, A History of the Jews in Russia, gave rise to charges of anti-Semitism and was not widely read. He was a bitter critic of Mikhail Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin, the men who finally broke the communist system that he, too, had done so much to bring down. Ironically, Solzhenitsyn, the former Gulag inmate, was on cordial terms with Vladimir Putin, the ex-KGB officer. He praised Putin for trying to revive the Russian state. But his political influence had waned. His later essays sounded preachy and irrelevant compared to the early banned works that had kept Russians up late at night, furtively reading typed carbon copies. These works are what prompted biographers to compare the influence of Solzhenitsyn with that of Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. Martha Wexler, NPR News.
This next story is about an ordinary woman doing nothing very special on an ordinary day. But then, with help from science correspondent Robert Krulwich, things get more interesting.
I'm thinking of a woman.
A charming woman. Light, vivacious, though she was over 50.
Who steps out of her London home one beautiful morning to buy flowers for a party that she's throwing.
Yeah, she lives in a fancy part of London, a fancy neighborhood of London.
And, says science writer Jonah Lehrer, Clarissa Dalloway, that's her name.
I love walking in London.
Clarissa will wind her way shopping, musing, noticing things for 200 pages and become the central character in Virginia Woolf's famous novel, Mrs. Dalloway.
What she loved was this, here, now, in front of her, the fat lady in the cab.
During which we spend much time in Clarissa's head.
Peter, he could be intolerable, he could be impossible, but adorable to walk with on a morning like this.
The novel is set in the 19-somethings.
Mid-1920s.
Yeah, and it's written not from the outside, but from inside its character.
Yeah, yeah, people like Joyce were doing this too.
Yeah, but when you're inside a Virginia Woolf character listening into a mind, what you hear...
Sylvia, Fred, Sally Seaton. Such hosts of people and dancing all
night.
Is a
tumble of odd thoughts passing.
A ridiculous
faces,
little face beaked like a
things.
Bird. Oh, that house, that ugly, rambling old
She thinks
bits.
About salmon, then pearls, she's happy, then she's sad.
She felt very young, and at the same time unspeakably aged.
There's no logic to her thoughts. Instead, she's full of contradiction. Her mind scattered, barely held together, and yet somehow she does hold together. And she knows it.
I'm always here. I've got the sense of being this continuous thread.
At the beginning of the book, Clarissa steps before a mirror, her mind all noisy, but what she sees, Wolf writes, is
pointed dart-like, definite.
She's drawn herself together. That's what we all do every day. We all take this diffuse, disparate mind and draw it together, and that's who we are.
And what are the very last words of Wolf's novel?
The very last words are,
"For there she was."
And I think her novels are a search for what is that that holds me together.
Or how can my mind be such chaos and still produce a coherent me?
That's the mystery.
And 80 years later, for scientists who study the brain, that's still the mystery. We have 100 billion cells in our heads, and yet
there is no single cell in the brain that is you or knows about you or cares about you.
If Mrs. Dalloway's head is all random and disordered, when scientists look into the brain, same thing. There's no cell, there's no group of cells that seems to be in charge.
No, there is no center. There's no center. There's no there there.
And yet we have a sense that we are there, that we are a somebody. But where that sense comes from, nobody knows. In fact, today, when we look into a brain, Virginia Woolf couldn't have known this, we are anatomically divided into two separate compartments, a left brain and a right brain. So we're not just scatterbrain, they're two separate worlds in our heads. No doubt you learned this in ninth grade, so I'm going to play you a high school film narrated by Michael Gazzaniga, who with Roger Sperry did the original work in this area. Gazzaniga wondered, how divided are we? Could the two halves operate separately on their own?
Well, the way to get at this question would be to separate the two cerebral hemispheres.
Which was done to several patients who were suffering from epilepsy, because apparently it helps stop the seizures in those people if you literally cut the connection between the two separate halves. So they did, and the patients recovered. And did they seem kind of peculiar after that? Was anything different about
them? No, actually, you know, scientists looked at these patients for many years and thought they were mostly normal.
But on closer inspection, some of them began to behave rather oddly. In one case, a patient picked up a book in his right hand and began to read, but his left hand repeatedly slammed the book shut.
So one hand would be holding the book, the other hand would be trying to close it.
In the same person?
The same person.
So the guy's holding the book, and one hand keeps closing, smashing the book?
Yes.
Because the left brain, which can read, controlled the right hand. Its hand opened the book, but the other side of the brain, which can't read, used its hand to close the book. And as Dr. Gazzaniga put it...
And what we find out is that they fight over each other. One hand knows how to do it, and one hand does not, and so they more or less squabble.
In other cases, patients would undress with one hand unbuttoning the buttons, while the other hand would button it back up. One hand would open a door, the other slam it shut.
And these are almost mutually independent systems. It was as if two people were fighting over performing this task.
And strange as this seems, if you read Virginia Woolf's novels, she sensed this dichotomy. Her main character in the novel To the Lighthouse, Mrs. Ramsey, worships her husband one moment, dislikes him the next, finds something beautiful, then ugly, wants, doesn't want. She seems at war with herself, as Virginia Woolf writes.
Such was the complexity of things, to feel violently
two opposite things at the same time. That's what you feel was one, that's what I feel was the other. And they fought together in her mind, as now.
That's actually a very accurate description of these two separate hemispheres and the way they work.
So anyway, she felt it, and they saw it, this struggle for a self.
Yes, that in the end, they're describing the same thing, just from two different angles.
And the artist got there first?
Yes. It's the artist who identifies the mystery and kind of shows us how to live with it, in a sense.
And what Virginia Woolf says, you write in your book, is what everybody does is they take all the contradictory things they think and feel every day, and they pull them together into a story... about themselves?
Yes, and that the mind works a bit like a novelist.
That
we're constantly telling a narrative about ourselves to ourselves, essentially.
So what we call ourself is something we make up. We are just an invention. That's what you thought?
Yeah.
But since scientists say there's no conductor in our brain, nothing in charge, so who's the storyteller? Does Virginia Woolf know that?
No, I mean, no one knows. That's the mystery of the brain is the story so vivid, but who's telling it?
You who are listening to me right now, you know that you're there, that you're you. But how you know that, that's the central mystery of neuroscience today. And long before the scientists got into it, says Jonah Lehrer.
I think Virginia Woolf was the first one to really identify and frame the mystery.
Robert Krulwich, NPR News, New York.
Jonah Lehrer's essay on Mrs. Dalloway appears in his book Proust Was a Neuroscientist, and you can read an excerpt of that book at npr.org. By the way, our Mrs. Dalloway was Anne Bobby.
The publishing industry has long turned its nose up at self-published books, vanity projects that couldn't make it in the big leagues. Now the internet and e-books have given self-publishing a little more respect. Plus, here and there, a self-published book has turned into such a success story that no one in the book business can ignore. The Lace Reader, a new novel by Brunonia Berry, is such a book. NPR's Lynn Neary has the story behind the story.
The Lace Reader is full of the kind of plot twist that readers love to dissect. Its heroine, Towner Whitney, comes from a family of strong women who are able to read the future in delicate works of lace. This psychic practice is, of course, a fiction, a product of the imagination of author Brunonia Barry.
Well, I believe that I dreamed it up, actually. I had a dream that I saw a future event in a piece of lace, and it came true the next day.
If Barry had been able to see the future of her first novel, she probably wouldn't have believed it. In fact, Barry says, if it weren't for her husband Gary Ward, the book might still be sitting in a drawer. He believed in the book, and he believed they could publish it themselves. Unlike some authors who try self-publishing, Barry and her husband had their own business, which served as a base for the venture.
Gary and I were publishers of software. We had a games company, and we thought, we can do this. We're already publishers. It's kind of a laugh now because you run into so many different things you never anticipated.
Yeah, we were emboldened by our ignorance. We've learned an awful lot, but we knew just enough to get going, but not too much to stop us.
Barry and Ward began by thinking local. The Lace Reader is set in Salem, Massachusetts, where they now make their home. This picturesque seaside town steeped in history plays a major role in the story. They knew people in the area would be intrigued by that, so they began asking the advice of local bookstores.
We actually started with book clubs, which was kind of an interesting thing. We went to a few of the independent bookstores and asked them to give us recommendations of book clubs who would be interested to read a beginning writer, a fledgling writer. And the first two book clubs got just straight pages of the book.
In a box. Yeah, we didn't have any real printed books
That's
yet.
That's right.
It was very smart. It's very revolutionary. I've never myself known an author to come in and give me an early draft of the book and say, I really want to know what you think.
Hillary Emerson Lay is manager of the Spirit of 76 bookstore in Marblehead, Massachusetts. She says Barry was genuinely interested in hearing how people reacted to the book. It was flattering, says Lay, and it generated a lot of interest. Book clubs have the power to make a book these days, says Lay, and The Lace Reader is made for book clubs.
It's one of those books that you finish, and you have to turn around to someone who's read the book and talk to them about it. It has a very compelling ending that I can't really talk about, but it's something that you finish, and it makes you reevaluate the whole book when you come to the end of it. So you're dying to talk to someone else who's read it.
Eventually, Barry and Ward printed 2,000 copies of The Lace Reader. Word of mouth began spreading to book clubs around the country, and local bookstores talked it up. Booksellers also helped Barry and Ward make important contacts in the publishing world, which led them to a publicist who got the book to the influential Publishers Weekly. The Lace Reader got a starred review in PW, and the larger world of publishing and film took notice. Rebecca Oliver, a literary agent with Endeavor Talent Agency, got a copy of the book.
I started reading it at my desk, and I think that, especially in book publishing, the thought of self-published, there's sort of a whole idea of what self-published means, in that the author has probably tried to sell the book previously to New York publishers, and they're selling it out of the trunk of their car now. And you assume that there's a certain quality, unfortunately, to that work. And when I started reading it, it was so clear that this book was different.
Oliver became Brunonia Barry's agent and put the book out for auction last fall. Before the bidding even got off the ground, Oliver turned down a 7-figure offer, an offer Barry was ready to take.
The first bid came in, and Gary and I said, yes, we'll take it. This is great. And she said, I don't think so. So sit down and wait.
Oliver was convinced the book could bring in a higher bid.
You don't do something like that lightly, but I think at that point it was apparent that the people who were reading this book were falling in love with it, and it just felt like we've got to see it through to the end.
In the end, three major publishing houses were bidding on the book, and Brunonia Barry was able to choose the one she liked best. She signed with William Morrow, an imprint of HarperCollins, for a deal that is reportedly worth more than $2 million.
I don't think we still have realized what has happened. It's kind of pinch me, wake me up, but don't wake me up because I must be dreaming.
I remember walking around the living room when we heard the final number, just putting my hand on my forehead, sort of stumbling around saying, what just happened to us? I mean, it was just incredible.
In addition to the original deal, the rights to the book have also been sold in more than 20 countries, and there's interest in making a film. Barry says the whole experience is a fantasy come true. But Ward cautions their experience with self-publishing isn't typical. Some of the old prejudices are fading, he says, but it's still a tough road.
The process is a little bit more democratic today. You do have the opportunity to take a book that you can have edited and you can have print and take it into the marketplace and show that there's interest in the topic. But it's awfully, awfully competitive. And I just wouldn't want anybody to spend their life savings or anything like that, you know, saying, I'm going to get the Lace Reader type deal.
Luck says Ward played a big role in their success. And just like a delicate piece of lace, the whole thing could have unraveled if even one thread was out of place. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Our series, Three Books, invites writers to recommend summer reading on one theme. Today, we hear from screenwriter Joe Piscatella. As a teenager, all he wanted was to be in a band.
It was 1986, the age of glam rock, and everyone wanted to be a rock star. A six-string, a drum kit, even a saxophone would have been a more valuable commodity to the aspiring bands in my junior high. But with 6 years of piano lessons behind me, there was no time to learn a new instrument. I wanted stardom. I wanted a keytar. I didn't get either. So when I want to live the fantasy of being in the band, I turn to these three books. In Tom Perrotta's novel, The Wishbones, Dave Raymond is who I might have ended up as had I pursued a musical career. At 31, Dave lives in his parents' basement, drives a delivery van, and still dates his high school girlfriend. But on weekends, Dave rocks, at least as much as anyone can rock playing 15-minute versions of YMCA at the Ramada for drunk wedding guests. Painfully funny and woefully poignant, The Wishbones wrestles with timeless questions like, how long do you hold on to the dream? Does getting older have to mean growing up? And how do you face your girlfriend's parents after they catch you making out in their basement? Where The Wishbones is about refusing to grow up, Mom, Have You Seen My Leather Pants? Chronicles growing up too fast. Williams' comic memoir recounts his days in the 80s hair metal scene in the shadows of bands like Guns N' Roses. Honors high school student by day and playing the Sunset Strip at night, Williams navigates the pitfalls of a band on the verge of stardom. Dressing like a cowboy in leather and boots? Check. Having a manager who moonlights as a Lonnie Anderson impersonator? Check. Admitting to your algebra teacher that you failed your exam because you were cavorting with groupies after last night's set at the Whiskey A Go-Go, one of LA's hottest clubs? That doesn't happen to people who aren't in the band. If you can't be in the band, you might as well be an expert about the band. That's the tactic Chuck Klosterman takes in Fargo Rock City. Part memoir, part soapbox rant. Klosterman looks back on his formative years as the only headbanger in his North Dakota farm town. He calls Bon Jovi the Robert Frost of the Heartland and raises topics like, should there be a no-keyboard clause allowed for heavy metal bands? It's the sort of book that leads you to unearth mixtapes you made when you were 14. So if you can't be in the band, these books are your backstage pass to living the dream vicariously and far more entertaining than the rock opera I would have composed had the rock gods deemed me worthy of a keytar.
Joe Piscatella is a screenwriter. He lives where else? In Los Angeles. His picks for our series, three books, are The Wishbones by Tom Perrotta, Mom, Have You Seen My Leather Pants by Craig Williams, and Fargo Rock City by Chuck Klosterman.
Now to a new novel about a family struggling with another difficult ailment. The book, The Condition, by Jennifer Haig. And the condition itself, it's called Turner Syndrome, a genetic disorder that stops girls' development just before puberty. Martha Woodruff of member station WMRA has the story.
Gwen McCotch just isn't growing up. She remains little girl short and little girl shaped. Her father, Frank, a research scientist at MIT, insists they face their daughter's tardy puberty and find out its cause. Her mother, Paulette, who prefers to politely ignore unpleasant reality, reluctantly agrees. Some months of testing later, Gwen's condition is named. She has Turner Syndrome. Novelist Jennifer Haig.
In this section, Gwen is remembering what it felt like to be diagnosed with Turner Syndrome. She was had just turned 13 when she was diagnosed. Suddenly, everything about her had an explanation. Her size, her shape, her dramatic entry into the world, the tiny preemie in an incubator. The time she'd gotten lost in Star Market was no longer just a story. It was evidence of her spatial difficulties, her nonverbal learning impairment.
The McCotch parents, ill-matched at the best of times, haven't a clue about how to come together in order to support their daughter.
Her parents argued. After each argument, her father dragged her to another doctor, an endocrinologist, a pediatric cardiologist. Blood was taken, an ultrasound image of her kidneys, x-rays to see the bones of her hand. The injections would make her grow several inches if she was lucky. Of course, being Gwen, she was not lucky. A year later, she'd grown less than an inch. Gwen had Turner's. Her parents argued. her father left.
Turner syndrome's quite common, 1 out of 2,000 live birth females.
Cindy Dunham is executive director of the Turner Syndrome Society and mother of a 10-year-old with the condition. She's read Jennifer Haig's novel and says the failed fictional McCotch marriage, sadly, is realistic.
I would say two people just have to be able to work together extremely well. And if the marriage isn't made stronger, then most of the time they have very difficult issues, and a lot of times the marriages just don't make it.
Dunham says most doctors don't know much about Turner syndrome, so a lot of the parents she deals with are desperate for information. A diagnosis is particularly hard to deal with, Dunham says, because there's no known cause, no known cure, and no predictability about its physical effect, other than short stature and the absence of puberty.
Almost all people know about Down syndrome, but when it comes to Turner syndrome, every person that calls in that has had a daughter or is diagnosed themselves, they're very scared and fearful because they have never heard of Turner syndrome.
Novelist Jennifer Haig went to elementary school with a girl with this genetic condition, although she says she didn't know there was a name for it at the time. Many years later, Haig came across an article about Turner syndrome, which triggered a flash of recognition and her imagination.
I'm fascinated by the kind of dissonance there between being emotionally an adult woman, intellectually, having those capacities, those feelings, those desires, and being physically kind of stuck at this earlier point in life.
In Haig's novel, Turner syndrome gives the McCotch family an excuse to resist facing other, more pressing problems. The parents, soon divorced, hunker down behind their emotional barricades. The three children, Gwen and brothers Billy and Scott, are left to figure out for themselves how to mature. The novel, The Condition, is an ensemble piece. There are no villains here. And the center of this family's sad dance of distance is Gwen's mysterious disorder.
All these people think of themselves as defective, and they think of each other as even more defective. And the book is really about them learning to accept themselves as they are, and learning to accept the other members of the family as they are.
What Jennifer Haig is really addressing in her novel appears to be the human condition. Whether in the end our desire to have functional relationships will trump all our excuses not to. For NPR News, I'm Martha Woodruff.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.